We're here on Daf Tes Amud Beis. Yesterday we spent a lot of time on Tes Amud Aleph, on the sugi of Ravina. Ravina understood, just to review, that the Mishnah of Rabbi Meir and Chachamim as to whether or not the Edim could testify and condemn her to death, hence we need 23 judges. Well, the witnesses are excluded from such a possibility. They're disqualified, and that's because there was a third witness, and the third witness was a Karov or Apostle. Hence, we're going to apply the principle of Nimta Echemem Karov Apostle. They're all Apostle. And that's a reflection of Rabbi Meir Shita based on Rabbi Yossi, that if you recall, Rabbi Yossi said that you have tzirif kat even without hasra, which meant that as long as the edim came to see and for the purpose of testifying, and now they show up in Bezdin, they become part of the kat. They don't need any sort of an action, which Rashi identifies as gilui das, to demonstrate that they want to be part of the testimony. We just asked them, when you came to see the action, did you have in mind to witness it? Were you very serious about your role? And they answer yes. And that already makes them part of the kat if they show up in Bezdin to testify. And then we activate the principle of Nimtza Echemem Karov Apostle, Edusim V'Tela. So therefore, says Rabbi Meir, since the third witness was a Karov or Apostle, therefore there's no potential here of Dinei Nefashos. Hence, all we need is three judges. On the other hand, the Chachamim, they reflect the sheet of Rebbe, and Rebbe says that it's not enough to see and come to see for the purpose of testimony, and even to show up in Beis Din. We have a third condition, above and beyond Re'iyas Ha'edus L'Shem Edus, and Hagadah Sa'edus B'fnei Bezdin. We have another condition called what? Hasra. They have to actively give a Hasra. The omission of Hasra would exclude them from the kat. And Rebbe, if you recall, dramatically demonstrated this by mentioning the case where you have three people who witnessed a murder and two of them were related to each other. So what's going to happen? The murderer will get off the hook? There's no possibility of Edus here? No, the answer is that even an apostle, if he decides that he's not going to be part of the kat, and he does so by omitting a hasra, he's excluded from the kat, because hasra is one of the preconditions of tziruf kat. And as a result, we don't apply the principle of nimtza echemem karov apostle. So, in this kaima edus of bishar, meaning that we can validate the edus with the two witnesses who are kosher, drop the karov apostle out. He didn't give out hasra, he's not part of the kat. And therefore, the rabbanon of our Mishnah in Motzi Shemra, with the edim testifying against her that she had this nus action, they are testifying to condemn her to death. We need 23 judges for a Beis Din of Dinei Nefashos, because the existence of the third witness is irrelevant. He's not part of the kat. And that led us to the Ebois Ema. So let's take a look on Daf Tes Amud Beis, on the second line from the top, the Ebois Ema. Now, if I'm not mistaken, this is the seventh interpretation. The seventh interpretation of the machlokus between Rabbi Meir and Chachamim. And here the issue is going to be a different issue. Who has to give the hasra? Do we define Edim as a self-contained unit, meaning that everything that's necessary, all the goals that have to be achieved by this Edus, are built in to the Edim themselves? So hasra, which is a precondition in putting a person, a condemned criminal, to death, was achieved by the Edim themselves? Or no? We just have to make sure that the criminal was warned. We don't have to insist that the Edim give the warning. Kigon shehisru ba acherim. The hasra was not given by the Edim themselves. Lo hisru ba ha'edim. V'kam miflagi, the machlokas here between Rabbi Meir and the Chacham about whether there's potential in this Edus to condemn her to death. depends upon a pluta, a machlokes. By the way, notice the difference between the word kamiflagi and pluta. Pluta is the noun, and kamiflagi is the conjugation in a verb form, in plural, right? So pluta is a machlokes, and kamiflagi means, and they were involved in a machlokes. Now, who is this machlokes? Which are the two tanoim that are at each other's loggerheads here to debate this issue, whether or not the Edom have to give us? Well, that's Rabbi Yossi and the Rabbanan. This is a Mishnah. Until now, we've been learning a Mishnah on Daf Hey in Makkos. Now we're fast-forwarding to a Mishnah on Daf Vav in Masechta Makkos. Rabbi Yossi Omer, Li Olam Eino Nerag, you could never condemn a criminal to death for a capital crime. Achiyu Pi Shnei Ha'edim Masrumbo, unless the Hasra came from the mouths of the two witnesses. Shenemar, because the way Rabbi Yossi understood the pasuk of Al Pi Shnayim Edim, etc., Yumas Hames, means Al Pi Shnayim Edim. The Edim are a self-contained unit, as we discussed yesterday, and everything has to be built in. So the goal here, from the takeoff point until the finish line, is to condemn this person to death. That entire process and any conditions that are necessary to achieve that goal have to be built in to the Haggadah Eidim. So the Eidim have to be able to say, this person is Chayav Misa. Why is this person Chayav Misa? Because I saw him commit a capital crime, and not only that, I gave him a warning about it. So there were no conditions that were omitted here in putting this person to death. But the Chachamim disagree with Rabbi Yossi. Over there in the Mishnah in Makkos, they claim that the Torah wasn't makpid that the hasra has to come from the mouths of the Edim. The main thing is that the criminal, before he committed his act, he was forewarned. And if there's somebody else who, from a distance, would warn them, that would be sufficient. So if we go with the Shitas Chachamim, we understand that even if these two witnesses admit that they didn't give the hasra, but they testify the fact that there was hasra from some third party, then we have a Dina Nefashis case. Hence we need 23 judges. Because the Eidus is still Kshera. There's no requirement of a self-contained unit that the Asra has to come Mipi HaEidim. That the Eidim themselves have to give the Asra. That's the Shita of the Chacham. Rabbi Meir, on the other hand, holds like Rabbi Yossi, which means that we're adding another requirement, another technicality to Eidus. And when is the Eidus valid and acceptable? That's only if the Eidim themselves gave the Asra. In this case, the Asra came from another party, and therefore the Eidus is not complete. And if it's not complete, there's no way that we can use this testimony for Dinei Nefashos. Hence, all we need is three judges. Now again, what are the three judges for? So we have Rashi Shita, that's for Hefsek Ksuba, which means the following, that now we don't have testimony to put this woman to death, but we will have testimony that she had this nus relationship, and hence she forfeits a ksuba. But that's only monetary in nature, and therefore three judges would be sufficient. The Chachamim in our Mishnah say, well, guess what? We don't need the Hasra in order to condemn her to death, meaning we can have a Hasra as long as it comes from somewhere. It doesn't have to come from the Eidim themselves. If we were learning Masechta Makkos, we'd have to go into great detail about the laws of Hasra and what are the requirements of Hasra. For example, there's one opinion that Hasra could come be pi shade. Shade is, you know, a demon. But what it really means is that even if they hear a voice from Noahsville, then we have no idea who's saying it. As long as the voice is the content of what was said was, don't do this because you'll be suffering this punishment, that's enough to appraise the criminal before his act. Again, you might counter argue, well, I just heard a voice, I didn't take that voice seriously. But that's how far we're going to go. But again, all that is according to the Chacham, according to Rabbi Yossi, forget it. If the Hasra doesn't come in P-I-A-Dim, then it's not a valid Hasra. And now we're up to the eighth interpretation of the Machlokes between Rabbi Meir and Chacham. Yeah, we're up to Ner Shmini of Chanukah now, right? You know, I thought seven would be a nice round number. You know, the 7 days of the week, and the seventh day of the week is Shabbos, and seven is Kiderech HaTeva. But we'll Mi'al HaTeva. We have an eighth understanding of the Machlokes between Rabbi Meir and the Chachamim. And this Machlokes is going to be a subject in my Iyun Shia today at 10:30 is a very profound issue about what's called Bidikos. So let's just say a few words of introduction to this sugya. When the Torah addresses the judges as far as testimony, in other words, to interrogate the Edim, the Torah says in Devarim Perek Gimel, it says, Vidarashta Vichakarta. And those two words are conjugated verbs, the nouns of which are drisha and chakira. Vidarashta Vichakarta. These are drishos and chakiros. We're going to soon see that chakiros are made up of the most fundamental questions, and if the witnesses cannot answer those questions, then they don't qualify at all as witnesses. The drishos are a little bit more broad, they're important questions, so they go beyond the seven. And then we're going to find out that there's a lower level called bedikos. So for example, the Dayanim could decide to ask each one of the Edim, again in seclusion, what color was the shirt that the Rotzach was wearing, or the victim was wearing? And did it have blue stripes? Was it paisley? Was it a solid color? Did it have buttons under the collar? You know what I mean? Today, if you go online, you want to order shirts. I found this in my personal experience. You have to know all the terminology, because if you're looking for a certain kind of shirt, you know, they're like five different conditions. So by the time you add all the five different conditions, like nothing shows up on the screen. You know, there's no response. But anyway, my wife is down in America, so she actually found on sale four shirts that fit my description. So I'm very excited about that, because I wear white shirts, and to get white shirts with a pocket that's out of style, they don't make them anymore. Nobody wears pockets, you know, on a dress shirt. But I need a pocket for many, many different reasons, you know. So those shirts that don't have pockets, which I have in my repertoire, I use on Shabbos, because on Shabbos somehow I can get away without the pocket. I don't have to put my pen in the pocket, you know. So that's called bedikos. Bedikos means, you know, the judges can decide to interrogate the Edom on any question whatsoever. You know, fruit falls down from the heavens, and you want to find out, did the stem of the fruit, was it thick or was it thin? And if there's going to be some sort of discrepancy between the two witnesses, that's bedikos. And we're going to have to figure out whether bedikos are elevated to the status of gufa shel edus, is essential part of the edus. What the Torah specifies is what's called drishos vechakiros, vidarashto vechakarto. The Torah says heitev means be very careful. And if nachon adover, if you find that this nachon, you know, usually the word nachon is translated as correct in modern Hebrew, but in biblical Hebrew, in the original Lashon Kodesh, the word nachon means when two things are mechuvanim. Mechuvanim means there's no discrepancy. There's an absolute mirror image between the two. They're absolutely consistent. So the word nachon means there's a consistency between the stories of the two witnesses and the answers that they give to all the questions that we interrogate them with. And the Gemara derives from this later on, in the third parak, the Gemara is going to derive the conclusion that the dayanim, the judges, are absolutely obligated. That's a special mitzvah of chakiros ha'edim, and that includes sheva chakiros. Now, the seven chakiros are so fundamental because they basically all boil down to what's called makom and zman. Those are the two critical elements in edus. That means, where did it take place and when did it take place? So you'll ask me, that's only two questions. Why is it called seven questions? Because there are six questions that have to be answered in order to determine the exact time. We have to know what Shemitah cycle it's in, and which year in the Shemitah cycle, and what month of the year, and what day of the month, and whether it was morning or evening. These are all the six questions that address when did it happen. And then there's one question that says, where did it happen? And that's the seven chakiros. And those are critical, because otherwise there's no possibility of hazama, because hazama means that at that time you were with us in a different location. That's only feasible if the Edom pinpointed the time and the location. Fine. Then the Torah has something called bedikos. Bedikos, that's not critical. If the judges, for whatever reason, decide to forego bedikos and they don't want to ask any questions beyond these basic questions, that they have that prerogative. Now, since chakiros are essential to the testimony, if there's any discrepancy between the two witnesses, then he can't say nachon adavar, and therefore the avis is completely invalid. Additionally, forget about a contradiction between the two Edom. If one of the two Edom cannot answer any of those seven questions, he just can't pinpoint the time or the place, then once again, the Edom is completely excluded. On the other hand, in Bedikos, if let's say the witness, by his own honest-to-goodness confession, admission, he says, I simply don't know. Yeah, you ask me what color his shirt was. I can't tell you. So that's fine. If, on the other hand, there's a hakhasha, there's a contradiction, one aide said it was a blue shirt, and the other said it was a green shirt, that's going to be a problem. And that's going to be the issue between Rabbi Meir and the Chachamim and our Mishnah. Meaning, whether the Eidus, in such and such a scenario, could lend itself to Dinei Nefesh to condemn her to death or not. Kegon de Iskush Bibdikos. There's a hakhasha. Again, the noun is hakhosha, and the conjugated verb is iskichush. Iskichush. That's the way it's conjugated in Aramaic. Iskachush. Bibedikos. They contradicted themselves in the bedikos. Right? What color blouse was she wearing? What color shirt was he wearing? But lo iskichush bechakiros. As far as the chakiros are concerned, they both were able, each one individually, to answer the questions precisely and with absolute confligence, with no discrepancy whatsoever. Kamiflugi beplugta de ben zakai virabonon. And this is an ancient machlokes as to whether or not hakhosha bibdikos undermines the kashrus, the validity of the witnesses, of the testimony. This now we learned in the Mishnah. This is going to be here in Sanhedrin. And the Mishnah records a story and a machlokas between Ben Zakkai and the Rabbanan. The Edom came in to testify on a murder case. And the murder case took place underneath a date tree, a palm tree. And Ben Zakkai, who was the head of the Beis Din of 23 judges, he took the initiative to ask a bedika question. What did he ask them? Ukze te'enev. You know, a date is attached to the tree with a stem. Now, there are different types of date trees and palm trees. We once touched on this right here in this room with regard to a lulav. You know, which tree is can produce a kosher lulav. And there's something called the ukze te'enev. Now, there's what's called avim and it's called dakim. So I don't know if you want to write this on the board. Av, which is with an ayin bet, that's Rashi Tavis, ayin bet, I'm just joking, but nobody caught the joke, but ayin bet. So av means it's thick. There are some trees that produce dates that have a very strong and fat, you know, a stem that connects the date to the tree. You know, you really need a zhlub, you know, a lot of power and energy in order to pluck the and detach the date from the tree. There are other date trees where the connection between the dates and the tree is dak. Dak, it has nothing to do with the physician here. Dak means it's a very thin kind of a stem. So we want to know what happens if one of the two witnesses says that the stem was av, and the other one says the stem was dak. Now, obviously, this has nothing to do with the murder whatsoever. But Ben Zakkai was interested in interrogating the Eidus and trying to find some discrepancy. And he lucked out. He found the discrepancy. So therefore he disqualified the witnesses. The Chachamim disagree with him. They say that the Chakiros, those are primary. Those define the very essence of the Eidus. And that's where the Torah requires Nachon, Mechuvenes, that it has to be absolutely reconcilable. There can't be any inconsistencies or contradictions. But if there's an inconsistency in the Bedikos, then the Eidus is Kshera. And now we're going to have a whole discussion here in the literature. So what's the whole purpose of Bedikos according to the Chachamim? Do they deny the entity, the concept of Bedikos? After all, it seems like an exercise of futility. You can ask questions about the color of his shirt. This one's up there blue, and this Yenim, the other one says red, so you're going to accept the Eidus in any event. So why bother with the Bedikos? That's going to be a basic issue here. Excuse me. in the commentaries. So now let's go back to our Mishnah. Rabbi Meir holds like Ben Zakkai. And therefore, if these two witnesses testify about this nus, and there's a discrepancy in the bedikos, then applying the principle of Ben Zakkai, of uktzei tein, and that's what's called in the language of the Mefarshim, then there's no possibility of validating these edim as far as dini nefashos is concerned. However, let's make an important point here. Rabbi Meir says we require three judges, meaning that what? What kind of din are we dealing with?
Monetary.
Dini mominos, so monetary mominos. Well, what's dini mominos? They contradict themselves in bedikos. So there's a great majority of Rishonim, and again, this is going to be my subject for 10:30 today, that came to the conclusion based on this sugya, that as far as dini mominos is concerned, kuliyama lo pligi, nobody denies that even if there was a hakhosh, there was a contradiction in bedikos, we can accept and validate the Eidim. The whole machlokas about a contradiction in bedikos only applies to din and fashos. You know, din and fashos, the Torah raises the bar on what constitutes a valid Eidim, because the Torah is interested in saving the life here of the Nidon. That's called the Shavtei Devitzilua Eidim. And therefore, the Torah is going to say, says Ben Zakkai, and Rameir standing on his shoulders, that unless there's absolute consistency, even if the inconsistency is in the bedikos, ukseitenim, we have to throw out the edus. But that's only in dine nefashos. As far as dine mominus is concerned, everybody agrees that despite the akhosha in bedikos, the edus is kshera. Hence, Rabbi Meir says, let's drop down to three judges, or shall we say, let's start the case with three judges, because in the maximum, the, you know, the in the best possible scenario, these three let's start the case with three judges, because even in the best possible scenario, dealing with these Edom as they are, and we interrogated them, there's an inconsistency in the bedikos, we cannot possibly judge this case as a capital case to condemn it to death. But we can rely on these Eidim for Hefsei Ksuba, meaning that the husband who doesn't want to pay the Ksuba, he can use and rely on the testimony of these Eidim, despite the fact that it was Hakosh and Bedikos. And this would support, again, a main school of Rishonim who maintain that in Dini Mominos, even if there's Hakosh and Bedikos, we can still, and everybody agrees that we can still validate the Eidus. The Chachamim in our Mishnah, they disagree with Ben Zakkai, just like the Chachamim in the Mishnah later on, and Ben Zakkai and Uksei Tenim disagree with Ben Zakkai, and they hold that even if there's Akosh and Bedikos, nevertheless the Eidus is still Kshera, even for a capital punishment, Mises Bezdin, and hence we need a court that's made up of 23 judges. Once again, I re-emphasize the question that I hinted at before. If you all like the Chachamim, why bother with bedikos at all? I mean, it seems to be totally, totally irrelevant. Now, some of you may recall that back in the day I mentioned, I even think I wrote it on the blackboard here, the whiteboard, a concept called Din Maruma. Din Maruma means where the judges intuitively sense that these witnesses are lying. Who remembers the story I told about the Vilna Gaon? You remember that the they called in the Vilna Gaon, and the Vilna Gaon, you know, to figure out, you know, they there was already a suspicion, but the Eidim were doing so well. So the Vilna Gaon took each Eid separately and interrogated them, and they said exactly the same thing, word for word. So he started screaming at them, if you don't admit and confess that you're lying, I'm going to do this, we're going to excuse you, whatever threats he had in them. And they finally broke down and they admitted that the whole thing. So they asked the Gaon, I mean, there was no discrepancy. He says, it's impossible. It's impossible that two witnesses could say the same exact thing. That's the psychological experiment I told you about my wife, that when she took psychology at Columbia, so in the middle of the class, the psychology class, somebody came in with a gun and started shooting and ran out. The whole thing was it wasn't a real gun, but And then the professor asked them to write down on a piece of paper what exactly they saw. And no two people wrote the same thing. And sometimes the discrepancy was very obvious. Yeah, so that's what bedikos might be about, according to the Chachamim. Sometimes the bedikos, even though they go beyond the basic questions, and they're not necessary, but they may give the judges a certain sense of what's going on over here. And when the Edim start telling their story, and this one says, you know, it was Av, and this one says it was Dak, and you know, what's going on over here, and you really think that there's some discrepancy, it could be that at that point the judges on their own would call it a Din Maruma, which again, that leaves them that intuitive element, the sixth sense, which is not part of the strict regulations of Edus. But the bottom line is, according to the Chachamim, technically, if there is a contradiction between the two witnesses and Bedikos, the Edus is still valid, and therefore it could be successful in condemning a person, in this case a woman, to death. Hence we need 23 judges, as Dinei Nefashos. Ben Zakkai and Ramea standing on Ben Zakkai's shoulders rejects that idea. There wasn't an absolute critical necessity to interrogate the Edim with the Bedikos. There was no necessity for the Edim to know the answers to the Bedikos. They could have easily said, Aini Yodea, and that's not like Chakiros, where Aini Yodea apostles. But if they contradict each other, then we have to throw out the Edus, because that's not Nachon Adover, that's not Edus Mechuvenus. That was number 8. So at this point, Rabosai, we're going to take the sugya of Rabbi Meir and the Chachamim and put it on the side. I reserve my rights to come back to this machlokas, because I don't know if you noticed here, there are major tosas in here, this sugya. And this daf test that we're about to finish is one of the most profound dafim in all of Shas. I mean, in yeshivas, they probably would spend about 3 weeks on this daf. So what I did in 2 days, you know, obviously, we didn't get down to the uktzei teinim, you know, down to the nitty-gritties. But we're about to embark upon another world-famous, world-class sugya, which is called, I'll just write it on the board in case you want to jot it down, Palgina Dibura. Are you familiar with this? How many people have ever heard of Palgina Dibura? This is a major sugya. It just boggles my mind how the Gemara was so analytic. This is like hundreds, if not thousands, of years ahead of themselves. I mean, just so. What's the concept of Palgina Dibur? What's it all about? What happens in a testimony which involves a testimony against two people? Right, the crime is committed by a partnership. With regard to one of those two people, the Edim are psulim; they can't testify. But with regard to the other one, they're ksherim. Like, let's say they're related to one of the two parties, but not to the other. So there's a concept here which is Rava's famous principle called Palginon Dibur, which literally means we split their words. And what we do is we take part of their words so that the Edim are testifying, and we leave them out. And we ignore them completely because they have no right to testify about that or about him. But on the other hand, we take the other half of their Edus, and that half will stand on its own. And it becomes Edus Ksherah. And that means that we can activate this principle called Palginon Dibur. This is a very sophisticated analysis of testimony. So let's see the case. Omar Rav Yosef, do you have it? It's approximately, shall we say, about 10 lines up from the bottom of the page. The first word of the line is Yosef. Omar Rav Yosef. Hevi Habal Edim Shezinsa. Oh, wait a minute. I think I jumped the gun. Okay, everything I said is true, but I'm a few lines ahead of myself. We'll get to Palginin Dibur in just a minute. The sugya that comes before Palginin Dibur is the sugya of Hazama. Hevi Abal Edim. Now, the classic case of Motzi Shemra, which the Torah says that if the father could prove that his son-in-law, the Baal, was Motzi Shemra, then the Motzi Shemra has to pay Meas, so he has to pay a very strict, heavy penalty. That's the case of Hazoma. What do I mean by Hazoma? Hevi Abal Edim Shizinsa. The Baal comes in, and here are my witnesses. They'll confirm and testify to the effect that she had znus. Hevi Ha'av Edim. Now the father comes in with his pair of witnesses. Vehi Zimum, which is an active verb, the noun of which is Hazoma, which means Imano Ayisem, Li Ede Abal. So who's believed in this case? The first pair of Edim or the second? The second pair of Edim. That's the parasha of Kasha Zoma, that the Torah says we believe the second pair of Edim who say to the first pair, you couldn't possibly have witnessed this crime at that time and at that location, because at that time you were with us in a different location, Imanu Ayisem, in a place far away. So now the question is, what is the implementation of V'asisem lo kashizomam lasos li'ochiv? Meaning, the Torah says that we punish the Edim Zomimim with exactly what they wanted to achieve, what they wanted to impose upon the accused. Right? How do we say the accused? Because I'm not going to translate this word every single time. It's called the Nidon. Nidon means the person who is being judged. Okay? So whatever, it's a boomerang theory, so to speak. Whatever the Edom tried to impose, if the ruling would have been based on their testimony, on the Nidon, on the person who is standing on trial, we boomerang that back onto the Edom. Now, in the case of the Edom Abal, what is the upshot and the accomplishment of their testimony? Again, of course, every case of Edom Zomim, if we want to apply the boomerang theory, we have to know what the Edom themselves were trying to accomplish.
Death penalty.
Okay, death penalty. What else?
And
the money of the ksuba. Do you follow?
Yeah.
Now we can add a third element here, because they would be undermining the knas, the claim of the father that he's slandering his daughter and if he has to pay mea kesa. But we'll get to that on the separate cover. Let's just try to get by the question of ksuba. These Edim are testifying about two different things. Number one, about her guilt and condemnation in a capital violation. Number two, about the loss of the ksuba. Now I'm going to ask you the following question to see if you're following me, because this is a critical question of the whole sugya. The Edim and their accomplishment, was it a hybrid of two different people, or was it one person? Would the victim of the substance of their Edim be one person, one individual, or two individuals?
Clarify the question, please.
Yeah, maybe it's not clear. Later on, we're going to have a case where a person testifies against two different people. And we have to know whether Kasha Zomam applies to person A, that he wanted to, you know, to condemn or cause a loss, or to person B. In this case, are we dealing with a case where there are two people who are going to suffer as a result of the Edom Baal, or only one?
Two.
Who are the two?
The wife will be executed, and the father has to pay the...
I was going to say the wife and the first Edom.
Well...
Why the first Edom?
Well, wait, when you say the father has to pay, I mean, we're talking about what? Ksuba, correct?
Right.
Who collects a ksuba? Again, it's true that you have a technical point here, because right now she's a nara, but let's assume that he's going to divorce her or he dies when she's a bogeris. Who's really the owner of the ksuba? I mean, again, you're getting very sophisticated, because it's true that nara, that Motzi Shema happens to be a nara, but leave that out. I'm saying, in general, when a woman commits znus, above and beyond her liability to be condemned for a capital crime and she's going to be put to death, she also loses the ksuba. So the Edom really are victimizing one person in two different ways. Now, when we apply kasha zomam, again I'm going to test you, here are the two possibilities, either A or B. A would be that the Edim have to, number one, be killed because they wanted to kill her, and B, they have to pay the ksuba because she would lose the ksuba. That's possibility number one. Possibility number two is, we're going to say the following. It's bad enough that we're going to put these Edim to death, we don't have to impose upon them an additional chiyuv to pay for the ksuba. Now, intuitively, if you don't know anything, again, you gentlemen may be great scholars, but if you weren't a scholar, what should be the answer? The Torah says, "V'asisim lo kasha zomam lasos liochid." Should there be one penalty here, that means death, or two penalties, death plus the payment to the ksuba?
Should be two.
That naturally, until you become great scholars, especially those who are learning ksuvas these days, the third pack of ksuvas, if you don't know a certain principle, then there's no question that the Edim, to fulfill the kasha zomam, should be both put to death and they should be paying for the ksuba. Now you may say, well, once you're putting a person to death, like, what difference does it make? You know, he doesn't take the money down to his grave. But if he doesn't have the money, his yarshim, his heirs, will have to pay the money. Again, ksuba is a very heavy sum of money. Very heavy sum of money. So take a look at the statement of Rabbi Yosef. Hevi abal edim shezinsa vehevi av edim vezimum li edi abal nerogim v'ein mishalmi mamon. What happened here? They don't have to pay for the ksuba. Where is the kasha zomam? Now we need scholarship. What is the principle that Rabbi Yosef has in the back of his mind? Excellent. Kim lei b'derabamine. Do we have to write this down? No, excellent. Kim Leib the Ravina. There's an entire Perek in Shas, which I happen to be teaching here and there, called Elu Naris. And the whole Perek is about this principle called Kim Leib the Ravina. There are like 1,000 different variations and whatever. But basically, when you have to impose two penalties, and a person is guilty as accused of two penalties. One is Misas Bezdin, and the other is Tashlume Moment to pay out of pocket. Then we're very compassionate, right? And we're going to let him off the hook as far as the monetary payment is concerned, and we'll put him to death. That's exactly the principle that Rav Yosef is applying here in the case of Kasha Zoma. Now, you and I would have said that's simple, but it's not so simple, because despite the principle of Kim Levi Ramine, there's another principle here that says, V'asisim lo kasha zomam lasos liochid, that in order for the Hazoma process to be implemented, the Torah says there has to be an exact fit or mirror image of what he wanted to do to the Nidon, that now we, as we said before, we boomerang back on him. But the Gemara thinks that despite the V'asisim lo kasha zomam, we still have to, you know, pay respect to the principle of Kim Leib D'Ramine. Hence, the Baal will get off the hook. I should say, the Eidei Baal will be alleviated of their penalty of Ksuba, of Mamana Ksuba, because they're going to be killed.
Who would have paid the Ksuba anyway?
The Baal would have to pay the ksuba, so the ksuba is worth money. Now, it's interesting. How much is the ksuba worth? This is what's called, I think, in modern terminology, futures. And halacha is very, very sensitive to this concept. I always say that halacha is so ahead of its time. Ksuba is what we would call a future. Not only is it a future, but it's a conditional future, because it could be that the ksuba will never actually reach fruition. In one of three possibilities, or one of three possible scenarios, she'll never collect the ksuba. No one will collect the ksuba, not her or her heirs. And that's a case where she dies first. When my father used to officiate at a funeral, he would always read a certain poem, "If I Go First," if it was a spouse. Very beautiful poem. I forgot who authored the poem. Anyway, so if she goes first, then the ksuba is gone. So that makes it conditional. Number two, if either he goes first or he divorces her, she collects the ksuba. Now the ksuba is Masayim Zuz, an awful sum of money. How much is it worth? How much would you pay for such a document? For example, if Reuven borrows 1,000 from Shimon, and Shimon is holding on to a shtar that says Reuven owes him 1,000, how much is that shtar worth on the market? basically 1,000. Because there's no element of will, if, when. Okay, now it could be that the collection of the debt is postponed for 30 days. So then we have to subtract a little bit from its value, because I'd rather have $1,000 in my pocket rather than say in a month from now I'll get 1,000. Time is money. But basically, you might reduce it from 1,000 down to 950. I don't know. If it's only a month, maybe down to 980. I don't know what. In the case of a ksuba, that's a whole complicated story. Will this ksuba ever come to fruition? And on that, we have one of the most complicated mathematical sugyas in Shas, which is in ksubas on Daf Gimel. But be that as it may, I would say, again, just to make life easier for herself, that the ksuba is worth 60% of its maturation value. It's like selling bonds, right? Mm-hmm. And you know, there's a 60% chance that, well, let's say like this, there's a 75% chance that she'll collect the ksuba, but we have to reduce even that those points because it's very futuristic. It's not going to happen tomorrow. Hopefully he'll live till 120, and hopefully he won't divorce her. So when and how will she collect that ksuba is very, very complicated. So again, there's one mandi omer that you reduce it to 40% of its market of its face value. Another mandi omer says 60%, and Gemara has a whole complicated calculation about how that works. So when you ask me, what would these eidim be paying if there was no principle called kimlei b'derabim minei, and if we were to take our sisin lo kasher zomam to its fruition? The answer is they would pay the ksuba. How much is the ksuba worth today? And that's what they were mafsid her. Her ksuba, based on their eidus, is worthless. It's worthless. Before their eidus, it was worth, let's call it 140 zuz, not 200 zuz. But now it's worthless. It's not worth the paper it's written on, because she was mezana and she loses her ksuba. That's the thrust of their eidus. But they don't have to pay for the loss of the ksuba because of the principle of kimlei b'derabim.
Yeah, but there is no loss of the ksuba. Just the ksuba is worth nothing.
No. I'm sorry. Now I wasn't pedagogically. I wasn't clear. What I meant to say is that if not for hazama, the ksuba would be worth nothing, right? If not for hazama, after the hazama, the ksuba is worth masayin. So as a result of their eidus, right? Not masayin, but 140, right? As a result of the eidus, she lost a valuable possession that again, instead of looking at it as 200 zuz, cross out the word 200, put it 140 instead. That's what that shtar is worth on the market. If she sells her ksuba, which she could do, she will cash in at 140 instead of at 200. The eidim now say the ksuba is not worth anything. Then we're going to be mazin the eidim, and we're going to apply kasher zomah. They should be paying what they wanted to do. They wanted to take a shtar, a document in her possession that's worth 140, and rip it up and burn it, you know, turn it into smoke.
But
we have kimlei b'derabim.
But because of a zama, isn't it back in force? And isn't the husband still liable? Isn't she still going to get
That's
paid?
That's a question you should ask, Yossi, on every hazama. Why does hazama operate? We're going to put these two witnesses to death. Whose death do they cause? Nobody's death. Why? Because there was hazama. So you have to understand this boomerang theory that I was talking about. Kasher zomah means in theory, meaning if there wouldn't have been hazama, what loss would they have caused? No.
Okay.
Again, it's a little bit theoretical. You know, you have to be a little bit of a philosopher. What would have been the loss if those eidim, which later on turned out to be zomim, and nothing was accomplished by their eidim, but what would have been theoretically accomplished had their eidim been successful? They were trying desperately to convince the Beis Din that their true blue testimony, and that would have caused X, Y, Z, all these losses, they have to pay. Because that's what they wanted to do to the eidim.
Okay.
On a philosophical level, you can call it attempted murder. Do you know what I mean by attempted murder? Now, in most, again, I'm not a lawyer, but I don't know, but in most criminal cases of attempted murder, the punishments are very limited. You know, instead of life in jail, he'll spend 3 years or 5 years in jail, they'll let him out of parole. Why? Because somehow his victim survived it. Miraculous. It becomes attempted murder. But in halacha, it's something called azam. and in Hazama, attempted murder is elevated to the level of murder mafish. Why that's so, I can't tell you. Just like I can't answer the question, why do we believe the second pair of Edom and not the first pair of Edom? The second pair of Edom say, we were in Chicago. The first pair of Edom say, no, we were in New York. Why do you believe the second pair of Edom? And that's the concept of Chidushu, that the Torah is Mechadish, this parish of Edom Zom. But we're not going to apply Kasha Zomam 100% because of the principle of Kim Leib and the Rabbi. So instead of having the Edom, in addition to being put to death, paying the ksuba, because they took a ksuba, again, it's all theoretical, right? They took a ksuba that was worth 140 and they made it worth nothing because their edus was that she was mezana. They don't pay that fine. Which is good news for the heirs. It's not such good news for them anyway, because, you know, well, you know, maybe even for them, you know, they, I want to go down owning that money, you know what I'm saying? Some people find money is worth more than their life, right? B'kol modeh. Right, now we go on. Chazar vehevi habal edim vizim humli edi'ah. Wow, this is already round three. So round one was the edi habal testified that she was mezana at such a place, such a time. Round number two was the father brought in two witnesses who said, are you with us at that time in Chicago? Now the Baal brings in another pair of edim. Again, it has to be a third pair of edim. It can't be the original edim because they're already on trial now. But another pair of edim he found that testify that the edim ha'av, who are the edim ha'mazimim, couldn't have been in Chicago at that time because they were in Arizona at that time. You know, in Phoenix, Arizona. So what do we do now? Well, at this point we have to consider, what would the Edei Ha'av have accomplished? What was their Kasher Zomam? And then we're going to reflect it back onto them. Or deflect it back onto them, right? So guess what? Surprises of surprises. Ne'ragim u'mishalmim mamon. What are we suspending now? Kim Leib the Ramine, why? Again, I don't know the answer until I go through this sugi with you together. But do you hear the revolution here? And this is all the same Rabbi Yosef. And he's saying that the Edei Ha'av will both be killed and they will pay Mammon. But here on both sides, we have to know what Mammon we're dealing with. Until now, what Mammon have we been dealing with? Ksuba. Now we're shifting. We're shifting to the Me'as Lion. We're shifting to the Knas of Motzi Shemra. Why? Because the Edei Ha'av wanted to accomplish two goals. Number one, they wanted to put the Edei Ha'bal to death. And number two, they wanted to testify and support the claim of the Av that this man, this son-in-law of mine, is a big slanderer and he has to pay mass lion. So they had a double intention. But Rabosai, what principle here seems to be totally trampled on, suspended, as I called it before? Kim Leib the Rabbinay. What happened to Kim Leib the Rabbinay? So now I go back to asking my original question. Mm-hmm. How many victims do we have? What do I mean? Any time of Hazoma, and we apply the principle of Kasha Zoma to the Edom Zomim, we have to ask the following question. Did they try to impose two different things on one victim or two different things on two different victims? In this case, it's on two different victims. Why? Because first, who's on trial? The Edei Ha'bal. The Edei Ha'bal claimed that they saw this nus on the corner of 3rd Avenue, etc., etc., at 4 p.m. in the city of New York, right? And now the Edei Ha'av are saying you could have been in New York at that time because you were with us in Kalamazoo, right? But not only that, keep in mind that the Edei Ha'av are now testifying not only against the witnesses of the Baal, but they're also testifying on behalf of the Av to force the Baal to cough up Me'asah Eslayim. They hear the two victims. And that's what the Gemara says in the name of Yosef in the next line. Edei Ha'av ne'ragim u'mishalmim mamon, they pay the Me'asah. Because it's mamon lezeh u'nefashos lezeh. No, it's not only were they attacking the Edei Ha'bal by saying Yimono Yisem, and now the Edei Ha'av are now subject to Azoma, but they're also at the same time attacking the Baal himself. because the Baal, as the Eidiyav claim, have brought false witnesses, and those false witnesses have to be put to death. The Baal is also claiming with his Eidim that he is not going to have to pay Me'as Loyim. The Eidiyav now testify that the Eidiyav have to be put to death and the Baal has to pay Me'as Loyim. That's called, in the Lashon of the Gemara, Maman Lezeh Nefashos Lezeh. There are two victims here. The Eidiyav are, number one, putting the Eidiyav Baal on trial to be condemned to death, that's called Nefashos Lezeh. But at the same time, they're putting the Baal on trial for having claimed that claiming that he slandered this woman, and therefore he has to pay Me'as Loyim.
So the Kublai doesn't apply.
And the Kublai doesn't apply. Now this principle of Maman Lezeh Nefashos Lezeh is a problematic principle. I'll tell you why. Because I'm learning the third parak of Ksuvas, and it's amazing to me that Hashgacha Pratis that I'd be learning the first parak of Sanhedrin and the third parak of Ksuvas simultaneously. And believe me, when I took on these two misimot, you know, these two projects, I had no clue there'd be any overlap between the two, Sanhedrin Lechud and Ksuvas Lechud. But here's the overlap. Amar Rav Ashi, in the third parak of Ksuvas on Daf Lamed Aleph, I can even quote the Daf, which I can never do, but because I just learned it. Amar Rav Ashi, Zorak Chetz, Mitchilas Dalet, Ad Sof Dalet, Vekarashi Raim Shel Chavero, is Nerag V'Eino Mishal. Rav Ashi says, if you shoot an arrow in the middle of Rosh Hashanah on Shabbos, and it goes from the beginning of four Amos, where he projects the arrow, and it flies and lands at the end of four Amos in Rosh Hashanah, he gets killed. Despite the fact that he destroyed, you know, I always gave the example of you remember the clotheslines, you know, here in where I live in Katowice, you see this all the time. Depends on sociology, but people hang up their clothes on the line, right? So he shoots the arrow and it pierces through Yenim's shirayim. He has very expensive silk that he's hanging out there, and it rips the shirayim, lands at the end of four Amos. Does he pay for shirayim? He doesn't pay for shirayim because of kimlei right. What happened to our Gemara? Maman lezeh unefashos lezeh. He's not chayev Nizikin as a mazik to the Baal HaShirayim because of the same reason he's chayev misa. Now, sometimes I could be chayev to you and for two things, right? But in this case, there's a pure coincidental overlap of chayev misa for violating the Shabbos and a chayev mamon for Nizikin. We have two victims over here. We have one victim, which is the Shabbos, if you want to call it. He desecrated the Shabbos. And at the same time, simultaneously, he destroyed someone's property, which is called Maman Lezeh. In other words, that person is out. Let me put it to you in Balabatish terms. Why should the Baal HaShirayim have to suffer a loss just because this guy is Chayav Misa? That's not my business. If he violated the Shabbos, he'll suffer the repercussions for that. I don't have to lose my shirayim for that. He ripped my shirayim. Same thing here. The Edim are going to be put to death, right? Let's go through the testimony of the Av. The Av turns to the Eidiyav Baal and he says, they say that you were with us in Chicago, right? So you deserve to die because you wanted to testify against this fellow's daughter that she's chayav feishes nish. Then they turn to the Baal and they say, I'm talking about the Eidiyav who are going to become Zomimin in just a minute, right? And they say to the Baal, you have to pay Me'as Loyim. So why should the Eidim be able to say, okay, now enter stage the third pair of Eidim who are Mazim the Eidiyav, right? So the Eidiyav say, you know what? You're going to put us to death because of our Zmama against the Eidiyav Baal. Well, Why should the Av have to lose his rights to Me'as Loyim? It's Nefashos Lezeh or Maman Lezeh. And this Gemara of Mamun Lezev and Fash Lezev seems to be contradicted by the famous dictum of Rav Ashi applying Kimleim the Rabinate to Azorek Mitchilas Dal Vesof Dal Vekarashim Raim Shel Chavira. So the Ran tries to understand and reconcile the two sugyas. And the Ran says the following, that when do we apply the principle of Mamun Lezev Unefashis Lezeh, that's only when there are two human beings that are being victimized. And the upshot or the repercussion of one of the two victims is death. And the upshot of the other victim is to pay mamon. So in that case, since there are two victims, each victim has to be dealt with separately, and we're going to say mamon lezeh unefashis lezeh. We're going to suspend the principle of kimle deram. But in the case of Shabbos, there's no victim. There's no human victim. The Torah says that for this terrible action that you did, you know, you violated Melech Shabbos with Otzah, you will get death. So that death now triggers off a kimle b'derabinei not to pay mamon for any nezikin that coincided with that chiyuv misa. In other words, at the same moment that you were chayuv misa for violating Hotzah Shabbos, in this case mavir daladam, at that moment you incurred a chiyuv nezek. So the din is kimle b'derabinei. Why? Because we have an overlap here of a chiyuv misa and a chiyuv mamon. When do we apply the principle of mamon lezeh nefashis lezeh? The emphasis is on the word lezeh. Lezeh means to him. You tried to put him to death. You tried to cause him a monetary loss. There are two different victims. Each victim has a right to claim his due punishment. In other words, the replacement for what again, in it, you always have to keep in mind that in Azom it's a theoretical, right? What would have been suffered as a result of their avos. Had their avos been accepted, this person would be put to death. That person would have lost 100 slain. That's called mamon lezeh u'misa lezeh. And this leads us to the sugya of Palgin Dibura that I put on the blackboard prematurely. The only thing is, we don't have that much time. So what I'm going to do now in the next 2 minutes that we have is read to you a commentary here in the Masifta. And he writes the following. Ein tzarech lomar. The Gemara didn't have to go out of its way when it said in the first case of Ksuba. Just 1 second. So now let's go back to the first statement of Rav Yosef. What was the first statement of Rav Yosef? Hevi Av Eidim Vezimum LiEidi Abal. So what happens to the Eidi Abal? Now keep in mind, the Eidi Abal wanted to do two things. They wanted to put Hut to death, and they wanted to support the claim of the father. The husband, that the ksuba is invalid. Oh, that does not lend itself to the principle of mamon lezeh unefashis lezeh, and therefore we're going to apply the principle of kimle b'derabinei. In other words, the Eidi Abal will not pay for the hefsed ksuba. Why? Because she was victimized. Number one, to be put to death. So here's a classic application of the rule of kimle b'derabinei, because the entire thrust of the punishment is focused on her as a victim. That's what the Eidim tried to do. They tried to put her to death and tried to be mafsid her the ksuba. So he says here, ein tzarech lomer, there was no need for Rav Yosef to say she'ein mishalmin la es melo schum haksuba, that they don't have to pay for the full face value of the ksuba. Sharei lo efsida kol kach harbe, she wouldn't have lost 200 zuz, because how much is it worth on the market? The buyer is not going to pay 200 zuz. Mi Omar, how do we know that she'll ever collect this ksuba that he will divorce her? Well, how do we know that he'll die first? And not only that, how do we know when he'll die? Umi kevan shelo barur shehoyis asuy lekabel ksubasa, is therefore we ask the question, how much could she sell the ksuba for on the market, which is called, in the fancy technical language, that's called tovas adnah, that she has a certain benefit from the ksuba which she could cash in right now. Again, its cash value is a fraction of its maturity value. if she would sell the ksuba avur mechiras haksuba. And the buyer would say, im tiskarish, if she will be divorced, o tis alman, if she'll become a widow, is then she'll collect the ksuba. Now he buys the ksuba and he has rights to step in, and that's the skum that the Edom tried to be mafsid her. But in this case, the Edom are not going to pay that skum because of the principle of kim le bidirav. Okay, Rabose, we'll stop here. And tomorrow, Belineta will start the sugya of Palgina Dibura. And again, I reserve my right to go back to the sugya Rabbe and the Chachomim with the 8 variations. And maybe I'll test you, and you'll all have to hand in a paper summarizing the 8 variations. Okay, then. Have a good day.